It certainly is good, as Brother Paul said, to see so many out. We have visitors. We have a good number of our own that have been either sick or traveling or what have you. And it's so good to see so many out this morning. We're reading through the Psalms right now. And as of yesterday, you should have been Psalm 23. Today's reading by my phone, because I can listen to it through the app, is 10 minutes long. For the Psalms today. So it's not a long, lengthy reading that we're doing right now, but it's a benefit. There's a lot of good material in the Psalms. There's a lot of points to draw encouragement from, and there's a lot of things we can study. This morning we're going to conflate two different Psalms. We're going to look at two different ideas, from one from Psalm 14 and one from the Psalm we just sung, Psalm 19. And we're going to look at the idea of belief in God. You have Psalm 14, which some have called the atheist psalm. And then you have Psalm 19, which we often think about it, talking about the law of the Lord is perfect and all that we just sang. But the actual idea of Psalm 19 is God of creation and who God is and how His work is magnified through the stars and through His law and through all that. So we're going to conflate the two this morning. What we simply have is God calls the atheist a fool. This psalm, atheism is traced to its prime source, and that being the human soul. The psalm reveals that atheism is not a mental problem, but a moral problem. What we find in this psalm is that one person cannot believe. It is not that a person cannot believe in God, but that he won't believe in God. And oftentimes atheism comes from a place of they think they've been rejected. They think that God does not hear them. They take up issue. The very thought that God poses a threat, therefore God must be ruled out of the universe, is what is the idea. What we see in Psalm 14, though, I want to suggest you, is we see four different men. This is where we're going to start, the four men of Psalm 14. The first man is found in the first two verses. It says, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have committed abominable deeds. There is no one who does good. The Lord has looked down from heaven upon the sons of men to see if there are any who understand, who seek after God." What we find in the first man is the foolish man. We're going to make it easy. All four men are going to start with an F. The foolish man. We see that it is human folly. Confession of human folly. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Man has determined that for himself because he has done corrupt deeds. You catch that in the last part of verse 1. Committed abominable deeds. But yet he says, there is no God. One who practices wickedness has said in his heart, there is no God. Whether we come right out and say we believe in God or not, it is evident in the way we act. Our actions will describe if we believe in God and if we fear Him or if we think He's just some inanimate object. We see the completeness of human folly in these verses. No one does good. The Lord has looked down from heaven upon the sons of men to see if any who understand, if any seek after God. It is because of their own human intuition they say there is no God. They've tried to put God on their own logic. That's what the atheist does. Paul touched on that briefly this morning in our Bible class. People will lay claims to different things in the Bible saying, you see, it contradicts it. They try to put God logically into human minds. God's not something you think of logically because He defies what we call our own human logic. You have the folly of the human because he believes that he knows everything. That's who the fool really is. Oftentimes people think the fool is the person who doesn't know anything, is clumsy, just says all these foolish things because they just don't understand. No, the fool is the one who thinks he knows everything. That's who the fool is. And you see that in his mind because he says there is no God. But not only is he the foolish man, he is the filthy man. Verses 3 and 4. They have all turned aside, together they have become corrupt. There is no one who does good, not even one. Do all the workers of wickedness not know, who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call upon the Lord? Man is impure when he considers that God does not exist. Man, notice that in verse 3. They have all become corrupt. They have become corrupt. There is no one who does good, not even one. This idea that there is no God corrupts a man. This idea causes him to be impure. This idea can cost him his life and cost him his eternity. Do all the workers of wickedness not know, who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call upon the Lord? Notice verses 5 and 6. There they are in great dread. For God is with the righteous generation. Who would put to shame the counsel of the afflicted? But the Lord is his refuge. Do they not know? What is it they do not know? That God is taking care of His people. And I want to suggest to you that becomes evident when this life is over, because what you end up finding then is the fearful man. You have the foolish man who says there is no God, and because there is no God, he defiles himself and becomes the filthy man who becomes corrupt and corrupts those around him. But I want to tell you that man eventually becomes the fearful man. Because the fearful man is suddenly confronted by God. God is with the righteous generation. He is not only confronted by God, he is convicted by God. You put shame the counsel of the afflicted, but the Lord is his refuge. What's the psalmist talking about? He is talking about the folly and the wickedness of man. Man has said in his own heart, there is no God. Man has determined that God does not exist because of his own human intuition. Because of such, it doesn't matter what he does. There are some real morally right atheistic people, and I honestly don't understand that. Because if there is no God, what would be the consequences of my actions? And that's why you have the filthy man. Because since nothing matters, because there is no God, I'm not going to be held accountable for it. I can live this life the way I want to, and when it's over, it's over. He does whatever he wants to. But then on the day of judgment, and what the psalmist is getting at is, even through the folly and the wickedness of man, God will vindicate the righteous. God will help the righteous. And he will confront and convict God. The first three men are all one and the same. They're all different levels of that. But the fourth man is he's found in verse 7. Oh, that the salvation of Israel would come out of Zion. When the Lord restores his captive people, Jacob will rejoice, Israel will be glad. So you have this first man, who we call the atheist, the one who says there is no God. He's foolish, he is filthy, and he will be fearful when confronted with the life he's lived. But then there's the man who lives in fear throughout his whole life, that is afraid of God, because he is the faithful man. That's who the fourth one is, that's found in verse 7. And I want you to notice, in verse 7, the Lord restores his captive people. Jacob will rejoice. Israel will be glad. Some versions actually use a word there that means laughter. The faithful man longs for God. The faithful man laughs because anything of this world is temporary. Anything of this world will not matter when the life is over. And so he longs to be with God. He laughs because he will be the one who stands in the day of judgment. So now come to Psalm 19. You have the first psalm that we talked about that describes who the atheist is. But now we have the God of creation. I want to read you this quote from Abraham Lincoln. He says, "I can understand how a man could look at earth and be an atheist, but I cannot understand how a man could look at the heavens and say, I don't believe in God." Psalm 19 looks at the heavens. It shows the magnificent power of God in the stars. There is original witness in creation and further witness in Revelation. One is His witness in the Old Testament. The other is His witness in what has been graphically called the Oldest Testament. The stars declare the handiwork of God. We can find God either in the sacred scriptures, as the last part of Psalm 19 talks about, or we can find Him in the starry skies, the first part. That's why truly the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Because everywhere you look, there is overwhelming evidence that there is a creator. Even scientific people who would describe themselves as probably agnostic will not admit to being complete atheists, because the way science is, the complexity of it, did not happen by chance. But I want you to notice this psalm with me. Let's read the first six verses. This is God revealing Himself in the stars. "The heavens are telling the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of His hands. Day to day it pours forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their utterances to the end of the world. In them He has placed a tent for the sun, which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber. It rejoices as a strong man to run its course. Its rising is from one end of the heavens, and its circuit to the other end of them. And there is nothing hidden from its heat." The witness of the heavens, I want you to notice, is unmistakable, verse 1. You cannot deny it. You cannot unsee it. Every single person looks up at the same sky. When I was growing up, a lot of literature would use a phrase to talk about equality between the different races, to talk about equality between different genders, to talk about a bunch of different equality. But it would be, do we not all sleep under the same sky? Do we not all look up at the same moon and the same stars? What they were actually saying there, without realizing it, is, aren't we all under the same hand of God? Aren't we all made by God? It is unmistakable, but it is also untiring. It does not end. Verse 2. "Day to day it pours forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge." There isn't a time you can look up at the sky and not see the handiwork of God. Even when there are storms and you see the clouds in the sky and lightning and thunder, that's the hand of God. There's not a single time you can't look up in the sky and see the creation. It is also unlimited. Verses 3 and 4. "There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard. But the line has gone out through all the earth, and their utterance is the end of the world. Their power is unlimited." Generations who've been before us can look to the sky. Generations who will be after us will be able to look to the sky. People in Asia can look to the sky. We can look to the sky. It's the same sky. It's the creation of God. The stars preach all languages and they reach all lands. But what you have at the end of verse 4 and 5 and 6, where it talks about its risings from one end to the other, it is understandable. That may not seem true, because the sky is complex, just like science. The different atmosphere and stratosphere, the way the clouds work, the way that the stars shine and go out, the way that the planet moves, and so you can see meteor showers and comets. It's so complex that it's understandable that it had to have had a creator to design it. Sometimes we think complex things cannot be understood. Complexity in and of itself signifies a designer. But then you have verses 7 through 14. And this is where God reveals Himself through the Scriptures. It says, "The law of the Lord is perfect, restoring the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true, they are righteous altogether. They are more desirable than gold, yes, than much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey and the drippings of the honeycomb. Moreover, by them your servant is warned. In keeping them there is great reward. Who can discern his errors? Acquit me of hidden faults. Also keep back your servant from presumptuous sins. Let them not rule over me. Then I will be blameless. Then I shall be acquitted of my great transgression. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer." This is where we're going to spend just a moment, because there's a few things we need to point out. There are two P words that describe this part. His word is both precious and powerful. The precious is described, verses 7 through 10, showing what the law of the Lord, the testimony, the precepts, the commandment, what it all does. And then it says it's more desirable than gold and sweeter than honey. The way David described it tells us what we need to know. Found inside the Word of God is restoration, is wisdom, is rejoicing, is enlightenment, is cleanness, is righteousness. You just thought David was describing it by saying law, testimony, precepts, fear, judgments. That's all really the same thing. He's describing what the Word is. He's describing what it can do. Yes, he uses phrases like it is perfect, it is sure, it is righteous. All of those are great adjectives of the Word of God. What we need to know is what it does and how to apply it. And then you notice verse 10 and the way he describes it. More desirable than gold, sweeter also than honey. I'm going to tell you, if I went out onto 46 and put up a sign that said, "I've got something that's more desirable than gold and sweeter than honey," people would be mobbing over me trying to find whatever it was until I said it was the Word of God. Because just a sign that says, "More desirable than gold and sweeter than honey," everybody would want it. The way David's phrased this is to show just how desirable the Word of God should be. Just how desirable it is for the one who understands it. Because it warns. It is powerful. There's that other P word. It is precious and it is powerful. It convicts, it cleanses, and it corrects. There's nothing more you can ask for. What's the point of all we've talked about this morning? Well, there are two types of people in the world, and I'm going to tell you there's no more than two types. Oh yeah, we've got these things saying that you can be agnostic, where you believe in a higher power, but you're not going to call Him God or worship Him as such. You've got plenty of people who think that they're religious, spiritual, not religious. That's how they describe themselves. "I wouldn't call myself religious, but I'm spiritual." Let me tell you, there's only two people. That's the one who believes and accepts God, and the one who rejects him. And those are the two people you find in these two Psalms. Now let's get down to the point of it. What does it mean to us? I want to suggest that there are even people in the church who would fit the first three men found in Psalm 14. The foolish, the filthy, and the fearful, because of how the Word of God convicts them. Because the reality of it is, as we've already said once before, either you accept God or you reject Him. There is no middle ground. And there is no one more foolish than he who would reject God. You will not find one more foolish than the one that rejects God. And you won't find one more filthy than the one who rejects God. Because did you catch that in Psalm 19? It's the Word of God that cleanses. You won't find one who's more fearful than he who rejects God. Because the Word of God will convict him on that last day. Many have said there will be no atheist in hell. That's right. But there will be a lot of fear. And it will never end. The Word of God has power to convict, has power to cleanse, and has power to correct. Moreover, by them your servant is warned. In keeping them there is great reward. Verse 11 of Psalm 19. How do we respond to God? Do we have belief in God? Then it is evident because we take the warnings of His Word. And then we keep them. We instill them into our lives. We become more faithful to God because in them there is great reward. Notice the psalmist says, "Who can discern his errors? Acquit me of my hidden faults. Keep back your servant from presumptuous sins. Let them not rule over me. Then I will be blameless and I shall be acquitted of great transgression." Man in and of himself cannot save himself. That's what the psalmist is talking about. Who can discern his errors? Man does not have the capability to do such. And so we must turn to God. Read that verse 14 once more. "Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer." Of the four men, only one will stand in judgment. Of the four men, only one agrees with Abraham Lincoln when he said, "I cannot understand. I can understand how a man could look at earth and be an atheist, but I cannot understand how a man could look at the heavens and not believe in God." What about you? By your actions, you answer the question, do you believe in God? If you're here this morning and you are not living right or you've not obeyed the will of God, then you've answered the question, do you believe in God? Because if you do, then you obviously don't fear Him if you won't make your life right. And if you won't fear Him, then you don't truly believe in God. What state are you in this morning? Tonight, we're going to look at the names of God. They're all Jehovah, but there's Jehovah Jireh, there's Jehovah Shalom. There's seven different names of God that include the name Jehovah. We're going to look at seven different passages that give the name of God in each of them. Then there is one psalm, and it's the only place recorded in the Bible, that all the aspects of God are found in the same psalm. All seven aspects because each name has a different aspect. Jehovah Shalom has one. Jehovah Jireh has one. Each of them has their own aspect. And there's only one place in the Bible that shows all seven aspects in one. If you have a guess, you can tell me tonight before services. But the important thing to realize is God has so many different attributes. One of them is Creator. And one of them is Judge. When this life is over, you'll be judged by the Creator. Will you stand in that judgment? If you're here and you will not stand in that judgment, if you have not obeyed the gospel, we invite you to come now as we stand and as we sing this song that's been selected.